Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NSNI. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, inflation down, saving rates up, and all predictions are those trends will continue. So why aren't we making the most of the situation? Thinking of escaping the January blues and going on holiday, we look at how penny pinching could be costing you dear. We look also at our growing taste for zero or low alcohol booze, and it's not just for dry January, folks. And it's been a while since we've had a good coin story on the potty, so we have not just one, but three for you numismatists out there. Took a bit of a run-up for that one. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, the cost of living has fallen to its lowest level in almost 2 years. Petrol prices knocked the CPI rate of inflation down to 2.1%, which has many experts predicting that any plans by the Bank of England to raise interest rates could be shelved for now. So, a relief for borrowers, but we also have some good news for savers too. You can now get a one-year savings account that matches inflation. So, Lee, welcome. Just very briefly, what do you make of these latest figures?
Well, it's an interesting one, Georgie. Obviously, the long-term target is 2%, so 2.1% now is hovering just about where they want it to be. Big part of it is the fall in the price of petrol. We've seen that in the last couple of months at the forecourts. It's definitely fallen by quite a bit. Airfares as well have been something that's dragged it down. And actually, what they're saying now is that it's probably going to dip a little bit lower. Part of that is the Ofgem price cap, energy price cap, is going to reflect in the next month's figures. That's probably going to make it hover more towards sort of 1.9%, is what the sort of predictions are. And as you rightly said, there's some cheer for savers.
Well, we're going to get onto the cheer for savers in a minute. But I think what people are suggesting about the inflation figure is not necessarily what it's saying about the cost of living. Is what it indicates may happen next with interest rates.
Yes, so the argument is now that interest rates are very unlikely to go up anytime soon again. After a little bit of excitement last year when it went up to 0.75%, there were a few rumours that maybe it was going to nudge up to 1%. Wow, exciting times. But because of the sort of dip in inflation, it's likely now that while it's sort of at that level, experts sort of predict that it's unlikely that they'll tinker with interest rates. They're kind of happy with the rate of inflation as it is and how it's going. So it's kind of, if they start tinkering with that, it could be a sort of knock on in confidence and elsewhere. So, you know, while it's hovering around this point, I think that it's safe to say that they kind of like to keep things as is, because if they're hitting that target, it's kind of like, you know, if it's not broke, fix it type thing. And let's not forget the looming spectre of Brexit, which every time I come on the podcast seems like, oh, it's still so long away, but now we're in 2019. It really does feel like it's coming along quite soon. So I would be very, very, very surprised if anything happens with interest rates between now and the end of March.
Yeah, well, they're talking about November, I think, if it does go up. But it is, I mean, we had some house price figures and how people are feeling and sentiment about what's going on in the housing market. And I just think any of these sorts of predictions, when you have, well, we don't know what we have really, do we? And we say Brexit in March, but then we may not be.
What type of Brexit? What kind of Brexit?
Exactly. Well, let's not go down that rabbit hole, shall we, Lee? We've only got about 40 minutes. You then teased us with the savings rates, savings accounts that can match inflation.
Yes. So this is quite important because savers have gone a long time with low savings rates across all different sectors of savings rates. So we're talking easy access, we're talking fixed rates, we're talking ISAs. It's been very difficult to match or beat inflation, which is important because over time it will erode your cash in real terms. So a lot of people, I feel there's been a bit of a sentiment shift towards people are more keen now to invest, for example, maybe more keen to take a plunge in something like a stocks and shares ISA because they've seen the what inflation's done to their savings, basically. And it's very, very difficult to beat inflation. It has been for a number of years. But 2.1%, we've now got savings rates, I think it's almost 100 accounts now that beat inflation after this move. But not only that, 1 year fixed rate now, as you rightly say, matches inflation. But, Georgie, I've got news for you. Mm. I've got some exciting news for you. There's now a one-year fix that beats inflation because Gatehouse Bank, which had the 2.1% rate, have upped it today to 2.15%. So it's just a little over inflation. Now, there's also a trick that you can do to boost this to a rate that's more like 2.35. It's between about 2.35 and 2.4% on a 1 year fix. What you got to do is go via Raisin, the online savings platform.
Yes.
They're offering bonuses, right? So they're offering £10 on balances between 10 and 40 grand. They're offering £80 between 40 and 75 grand. And they're offering £100 for anything between 75 and 85 grand. When you crunch through the sums on that, for example, if you put £40,000 in, you would get nearer a 2.4% rate now with that, which is not to be sniffed at over a year. You have to go, as I say, through the Raisin online savings platform. It's pretty easy to do. It has the account listed in there. Gatehouse Bank is FSCS protected, which is a massive, massive importance. Whenever you're putting money away like that, you want to make sure that whoever you're putting it in with is FSCS protected, because it protects your cash up to £85,000 per banking license. I've seen a few things on Facebook this week, a few pages that have cropped up, including one that was like top ISA rates. And I clicked through just out of interest. I couldn't help myself. And they had some in there that were offering like 7-8%. And when I clicked through, you know, on the website of the companies that they're pushing, you know, Capital at Risk, it isn't FSCS protected.
Sounds too good.
Exactly
to be
that.
True.
So you've got to be careful, Georgie. You have got to be careful with these types of things. So also, it's worth pointing out that Gatehouse Bank that it's an expected rate. Rather than an actual, this is your rate of interest, because of the way that it's a Sharia based bank, which basically means that it's about expected profit rather than they don't do interest. But it, essentially, it's the same thing. It'd be very, very unlikely that it wouldn't offer that interest. So,
do you expect this trend to continue? That we're going to see more of these?
I do, Georgie. And actually, we did a roundup at the start of the year. Well, actually, it got published just between Christmas and New Year, where we got a number of experts, as we do every year, to talk about what they think is going to happen with savings rates within the next year. And a couple of them are saying we're looking at nudging back towards 3% savings rates for people, which would be great. You know, HSBC this week launched an online easy access account, which isn't a Best Buy, but it's better than what they have been offering.
Yeah.
So there are signs, there are indications perhaps that savings rates are going to nudge up a little bit over the course of the year, and about time too, I'd say.
I would say as well. It's interesting you talk about people wanting to invest a little bit more, because we've had a bit of gyrations, turbulence on the stock markets,
yes,
have we not, across the world. And I think anybody who's just dipped their toe in the investing water might have got a bit of a shock. And I wonder if some people are tempted almost to pull out of that and go back into savings.
The best advice that Georgie really is to keep calm and carry on. Because
if Simon were here,
he would be banging this drum. At the end of the day, if you're opening up an investing account, it's more of a long-term view. You've got to have at least a 5 year, preferably a 10 year view and beyond. I checked out my pension at the start of this year, and it's down 8% last year. And actually, a lot of people will say, "Oh, I don't invest in the stock market. It's too confusing. I don't know what it is." Most people invest in the stock market via their pension, via funds that are in there that are invested in the stock market. And actually, what I've done is I've done a big audit of it. I feel really sort of proud of myself.
I've done the same
as well. New Year resolution. I was like, right, last year I've upped my contributions. Perfect. Looking at the return, oh, it's down 8%. That's not good. I've diversified some more. I feel like I need to be getting in a little bit of UK, a little bit of global, you know, and actually engaging with it and having a look and seeing how past performance, of course, is not an indication of where it's going to go in the future, but it's good to diversify these things. I feel like my pension wasn't diversified enough. I feel like a lot of people wouldn't really know to go and have a look and see what funds they're invested in. But you're totally right, Georgie. And I think that if you want to just take your money out because, oh, in the last year it's dropped and you've opened a stocks and shares ISA. So my advice is just to keep going with it.
Keep
drip feeding money into it every month if that's what you're doing, and just ride it out. You know, over the long term, you'll be targeting a 5% annual interest, I would suggest. There's going to be peaks and troughs with that. And, you know, as I say, it's a bit of a cliche, but keep calm, carry on.
I had the same thing when I looked at my pension. Some of them are thinking, oh, my goodness me, that's not done particularly well.
No, I think everyone is kind of in that boat, Georgie.
But it's all right, I'm not that old yet. So let's just,
time is on your side.
Absolutely. Well, we mentioned Simon there. He's been writing, actually, about inflation and savings rates. And he's, like you, taking a rather positive look at this. Inflation, so the cost of living is down, potentially going further down. Savings rates up, again, potentially going up. Interest rates may not be going anywhere. So this is all good news potentially for our finances. But Simon has a warning.
He does. And actually, this is a warning that, you know, it does get said quite a lot. There was an FCA, even an FCA review about this. Is if you've got money lingering around in old savings accounts, floating around that are earning, you know, 0.1%, 0.2%, even if it's not huge sums of money, take that money out. You're just giving, you're giving banks arsenal to keep basically offering low rates because they don't need to entice savers in because they've got loads of people doing the same thing, just holding cash into really poor accounts that are paying a pittance. So what Simon's saying, it's almost like an action call. You know, if that's you, if that sounds like you and you've got these accounts lingering around and you don't know what interest they're earning or what they're doing, just get it out and just put it into this Gatehouse Bank or put it somewhere else that's going to earn you at least interest that's going to beat inflation. And if it is a small amount and you think, oh, what's the point, just take it out and spend it on something or do something with it. Don't just leave it lingering in the banks, because all that's going to happen is that the banks are going to continue offering rubbish savings account and what rubbish savings accounts. And what that means is that the competition, which we've seen in recent years, is not being driven by the big banks because they just don't need they don't need your money.
Yeah,
they've already got plenty hovering around in legacy accounts. And actually, interestingly, Georgie, I mentioned the experts I spoke to about what's going to happen to savings rates this year. I asked three of them, so there were three experts in there. I asked each for a tip for the year, what savers should do. Each one of them said exactly the same thing. And it was to switch if your money's in a poor account and check your old legacy accounts and switch. Because if we can get everyone to do that this year, if everyone that's listening to this podcast could do that, we're going to start seeing banks under a little more pressure.
You're banging the desk there, Lee. He's so passionate about this.
Because at the end of the day, savings rates at the moment are being driven by challenger banks and they're being driven not by the big banks. Imagine if we could get big banks in the mix to start having to challenge savings rates again. We could start seeing some much better rates. And I just feel like I just want to give people a big old kick up the backside and say, get that money out. Even if it's a 25 quid laying in a 0.1% savings account, you think, what's the point? Just take it out and spend it on something.
I've got a little story. I know, I've got a little story about this because I was totally shamed by one of our podcast reviewers. Feel free to shame me if you like again, because I'm the winner on this one. Is that we were discussing this probably about 9 months ago or something, and how I'd had some money left in my 0.0001% HSBC savings. Someone really nicely said, why should I listen to anyone on a podcast who has their money in a 0.001? And you're absolutely right, good sir. So thank you very much. I shifted about, put a bit of investing, opened my Marcus, and I'm a winner. So thank you very much.
Practice what you preach, Georgie. That's what I like.
Or what someone else slams me for, and you're absolutely right. But I don't think it was about my financial acumen, more my laziness. But we are talking about the cost of living. And Lee, I do want to mention this other story because I saw you getting a bit het up about it on Twitter. And this is RIP to RPI. So basically, we have this ridiculous system in this country where we have not one, but three figures measuring the cost of living that is used by the government. So we've got the CPI. Mm-hmm. That's the headline one. That's the one with the most famous, the 2.1% I was talking about there. Mm-hmm. We also have the RPI, and then we have the CPIH, which I'll get onto in a moment. Mm-hmm. But RPI tends to be between 0.5 and 0.8% higher. And where it's used by the government tends to be where they take money in. So student loans and rail fares, and where they use CPI is where they give money out. So things like state pensions, benefits, that sort of thing. Now, if this inflation shopping, it's called, isn't bad enough, it now seems that the RPI figure has, whoopsie-daisy, been calculated wrongly, and for some time as well. Now, the House of Lords, they say this is just not acceptable. They're calling on the ONS to do something about it. They want it stopped until this whole issue is fixed. So, Lee, what is the issue and how much has it been costing us? Because I think this all came about, 2010?
Yeah, so basically the House of Lords have done a report on this, and they have banged the drum about this a few times in recent years. And actually, it's just a technicality. It's quite complicated how these indexes are measured and the mathematics behind it all. And you could feel basically about five podcasts talking about it because it is a very, very in-depth subject. But basically, the Retail Price Index is the original index, right? It's the one that's been going since the First World War. It measures goods and services, as does the Consumer Price Index, which is a newer index. It came in the mid-90s. It basically was like an EU thing to get all the member states of the EU to have like a an inflation measure that was kind of similar, so we could kind of see what was happening sort of everywhere. Now, what's happened is CPI has become the more mainstream and used measure of inflation, and RPI has been sort of sidelined somewhat. And I actually genuinely think that this is a national scandal. I think this is a national scandal. Yeah. And as the House of Lords have pointed out this week in this report, the government is cherry-picking which measure of inflation that it wishes to use when it sets different things. And of course, what they are doing is penalising people basically by using two different measures of inflation.
Yeah.
And the argument is, pick one for everything. An average person on the street hasn't got time to figure out what it all means. But of course, what that means is that we're all getting diddled at the end of the day. I mean,
it doesn't help you if you figure out what it means. It means you're paying more if you're
a
rail fare user or a student loan.
You just get more heads up about it and you get more angry about it. It's kind of one of those things in which I don't know how it's gone on for so long and how, you know, like an independent body like the Office of National Statistics are even saying, you know, RPI is outdated and there should be more of a streamlined way of doing this. It just feels like whenever I've asked for an answer on this, I don't ever get a straight answer. Yeah. I just get batted off. No one really wants to kind of give you an answer. So I'm not sure if they know what the answer really is. Where this really comes into play, George, and where this really gets me, right, is train fares. And look, I commute. And I've worked out in the past 8 years, we are paying almost 10% more for our train fares than we would have done because they're linked to RPI. It's set in August, so they can rise it from there. If it was linked to CPI, we'd be paying basically around about 10% less on a train fare, maybe just a shade under that. So if you've got a £5,000 annual commute now, if it had been set by CPI rather than an RPI, you'd probably be paying more like £4,500. That's a £500 difference because it's measured in RPI rather than a CPI. And student loans, I mean, students have got it difficult now. I mean, £9,000 a year, that's not even factoring in how much it costs to live and all of that. So you're probably coming out with an average debt £50,000 plus. And then you're getting interest on it, which is RPI, the higher measure of inflation.
What they could have worked out was that adds on an extra, I suppose, over the whole course of the period of paying back, £16,000.
It's criminal. I think it's criminal. Students are already, you know, having to fork out incredible sums of money to get educated. It's all legacy stuff. You know, at the end of the day, there was a generation of people that got pushed to go to university and paid a pittance for it. And now this generation are having to pick up the pieces and having to pay absolutely incredulous amounts of money for an education, which is bad enough in itself. And then to have interest set at RPI. Georgie, I don't.
The annoying thing about this, though,
it's good enough.
The RPI figure is frustrating, but what the House of Lords are saying is actually because of miscalculation, it's been even higher. Oh, I'd love to see students and rail passengers and anybody else go and say, actually, hang on a minute, whoa, 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 let's figure out how much extra you've miscalculated. Because in any other industry, any other walk of life, you'd get some money back for that, wouldn't you?
No, it's incredible. And actually, one of the things that the House of Lords are saying that, actually, people who have inflation-linked government bonds are winners in this, basically, this mistake or this error, as they've put it, of 0.8%. And it means they've earned an extra £1 billion in interest. And it's almost like they don't want to upset the people that have got those index-linked bonds. And actually, if they then go back on this 0.8% and refund, it's going to cost them billions and billions and billions of pounds, and they don't want to do it.
No.
But where did we draw the line, Georgie? I mean, for me, I feel like it needs a big reset button and it needs to be said, right, this is the measure of inflation we're using for absolutely everything.
Well, CPIH, right? What is
CPIH?
This?
So it's exactly the same as CPI, but added on the cost of housing, basically. Mm-hmm. Housing is probably the biggest outlay for any of us in our lifetime. And what it includes are things like mortgage payments, rents, council tax increases. It adds that on and the argument is, I think it came in about 2015, this measure of inflation. They tried to push it as like, this should be the one. They say it reflects the cost of living more truthfully because of the housing element added in. But for whatever reason, it's just kind of not really been used properly. I think also what's happened in the last couple of years, of course, Brexit has taken away. It's obviously been the attention and the focus of the government, of course, has been shifted largely onto Brexit. And things like this are kind of, even though they matter so much, and it can be the difference between billions of pounds of interest if you've got a government-linked, say, bond, or if you've got a student loan, or you commute. It's kind of one of those issues that's been pushed aside. It's complicated, and I think it's probably just on a list of about 10,000 to-dos after Brexit. But the House of Lords is right to keep bringing this subject up. It's whether anything actually gets done about it. And, you know, the real takeaway from it is they want the government to stop cherry-picking. For example, one of the parts of the triple lock is inflation. They've moved that to CPI, the lower rate of inflation. Yeah. You know, things like that, and all the benefits are linked now to
your
CPI.
Your pension has to increase by
That's fair enough.
Wage increase.
That's fair enough. That, you know, let's keep it at that. But then why can't we set student loan interest at that, and train fares and mobile bills and all those sorts of things? It should be one flat, same level of inflation. That's my opinion.
And it will continue to be your opinion until it changes. And let's be honest, that ain't going to happen anytime soon.
You know, I speak to the Department for Transport a couple of years ago. This is basically compounding interest misery for commuters, you know, because the more that it keeps getting linked to RPI, the faster and quicker train fares are going to go up. Because if your train fare's gone up to $5,000, because it's now at $5,000 instead of $4,500, use RPI, it's going to be a bigger increase than it would have been at $4,500. And it is basically compounding interest on commuters. And I don't know where we draw the line. Of course, I'm talking about train fares a lot because I use the trains a lot. Can we really keep going in a way in which, if we keep using RPI and it gets driven by 2.5% to 3.5% per year, it's just getting out of hand. And if your commute is even more than that, £7,000-£8,000 for whatever your circumstances are, we're already getting stiffed enough on the trains with poor performance, delays, high ticket prices. It's almost like a kick in the teeth every year. And I feel like there's a big media storm around it for a couple of days, and that's it. It just disappears again until the summer when it gets linked to RPI again, and then in January again when the fares actually go up. Apart from transport, can't give you an answer as to why it uses RPI rather than CPI. I'll keep asking the question. I'll keep getting battered away, but I can only try.
It's a good job we've got this podcast, because Twitter just ain't enough for you, is it? Really?
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, we're midway through January, so how are those New Year's resolutions going? Perhaps the gym membership is still lying unused for January. That sounds really dodgy, doesn't it? Went out the window on the 2nd, as to dry January, and heck, according to media reports, you probably left your other half and your job as well. So to cheer yourself up, you might be thinking, as I am, about booking a holiday, and the numbers do actually soar in January. Ignoring the fact we are all meant to be broke and single. Although single holidays, apparently, Lee was telling me a bit earlier, are going up as well. So with the holiday, though, comes travel insurance. Do remember travel insurance. But while we are all about money saving, aren't we, Lee, here on this show, this is one area that I think we can all agree that scrimping is just not worth the risk. Now, your sister publication, Money Mail, have crunched the numbers here, and you don't actually have to pay a huge amount more to ensure that the policy you buy is actually worth the paper it's electronically printed on. So, Lee, tell us a bit more about what's happening here and what Money Mail have uncovered. Because clearly people are doing the right thing by getting cover in the first place. Mm-hmm. But this cover is not good enough.
First of all, we're going to say this, Georgia, with travel insurance. It's really vitally important that if you're going away this year, in my mind, that you should get insurance, travel insurance. Mm. And you should do it when you book your holiday, or at least as close to when you book the holiday as possible. Don't leave it till a week before you go away, or, you know, a couple of days before, because actually this year more than ever, we've seen, you know, for instance, the Gatwick drone incident, absolute meltdown at Gatwick. We've got Brexit on the horizon now. I don't predict that anything's going to happen in terms of flights and all of that sort of thing, but it's better to have a bit of peace of mind, isn't it, to have your insurance just done, ready there to go. So I bought travel insurance this week. We've booked our honeymoon, so I'm getting married in May. We're going to Mauritius. It's quite an expensive holiday, probably the most expensive holiday we've ever taken. I've done exactly what Money Mail... I did this before the Money Mail story came out. God, I feel so smug. Basically, when you're comparing these, especially if you're using a comparison website, most of us, you will use a comparison website now, it's really vitally important that you put in the right levels of cover that you need, right? So,
how do you know what you need?
Well, this is what I'm going to tell you. So, you need to know.
It's almost like we planned this.
But yeah, basically, so for example, in my instance, as I said, this is an expensive holiday. You know, we've pulled out all the socks this holiday. It's thousands of pounds, right? I want to make sure that we have got enough cover for the three of us. So me, Danielle, we're also taking baby on our honeymoon. We want to make sure that, you've got enough cover. So when it says how much do you need for cancellation, you want to make sure it covers the cost mm-hmm. of your entire holiday. Now, it only needs to be per person. So let's say, for argument's sake, your holiday is $7,500. You need to make sure you put $2,500 in that box, because it's covering you for $2,500, your partner for $2,500, and my baby for $2,500.
Got it.
Right. So you want to make sure that you've got the level set correctly. I would also argue that it's quite good to see that, you know, the de facto star ratings. Mm-hmm. Don't know if you've ever seen that. I think that that's quite good at shaping decisions, because if it's 5-star, I think that gives a kind of good little guarantee, basically, that you know that that's going to be a little bit of a stronger insurance policy for the needs that you've put in when you're inputting your details. What Money Mail is saying, and I think this is really interesting, actually, this is a really interesting story, is that insurers are fighting to get to the top of the comparison charts when you crunch your figures through, right? And for that reason, they know a lot of people just go for the cheapest one. And it's not necessarily the right thing to do.
And there's a reason it gets that cheap, is that you have to strip out all the good stuff.
You have to strip out all the good stuff
to get to that sort of
price. So what they're saying is that, you know, the protections can be so basic that you might not pay out if you have to abandon your holiday, your flight, or your baggage delayed. Or, you know, it's morbid, but if you get really badly injured abroad or even die. Now, that is morbid. But you need to make sure that you have the right protections in place. And actually, they analysed some data and they found that if you paid an extra £3 with the same insurer, you could benefit from £5 million worth of additional medical cover.
£3. Wow.
And £30,000 more compensation for problems with flights and baggage. Ooh. So when you go to do this, I would just say, it's a really boring thing, right? It's the anti-holiday thing to do, isn't it? You're going on holiday because you don't want to have to deal with the grind of home. All the paper, all the things you have to deal with at work. But it is vitally important to make sure you've got the right level of cover. It really is, because if you ever need to lean on it and it hasn't got the right protection because you haven't really looked, I'm not saying that it's hard to trawl through all of the terms and conditions, but what I would say is insurers have got better at kind of highlighting what is included and what's not included. They will send you that before you pay, so you can kind of have a look to make sure you've got what you need. I'd have a fiddle around with the higher the levels you can put, the better. Okay, it might cost you an extra £5, £10, £15.
Just think how much you're paying for that holiday, though.
Exactly, how much you're paying for that holiday.
So why not? Factor that in before you buy the holiday. Get it at the same time.
Exactly.
But factor the travel insurance as part of the price of your holiday.
And also, I would say, if you're headed to Europe, there's that danger of people going, well, I've got the EHIC, my hospital bills are covered if I need to while I'm abroad. And also, compensation for delayed flights over 3 hours, right? Okay, that's fair enough. Like, you know, that is there as a kind of, you know, safety net for travellers. But it doesn't negate the need for insurance.
No,
so,
not at all.
You know, don't fall into that trap as well. It can cost, you know, next to nothing. Some people have it included in their current account packages. Just make sure you are covered. I ended up paying about £50 for our insurance in the end, which is quite a bit for a one trip, but we're going halfway across the world. I went for a kind of 5-star de facto protection, which was about 8th or 9th down the list. I went for the highest level of everything.
Don't
that
just
was
go
there.
For the top three.
Exactly. If it's an expensive holiday, especially if it's an expensive holiday, you want to make sure that you're covered for the whole trip. And if anything happens while you're abroad.
There are certain things that they will not pay out for,
yes.
You know, the acts of God sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But we're getting more events like airlines going under, and you can mm-hmm. actually cover for those things. I was just thinking, not suggesting Ryanair are going to go under, of course, but they released a profits warning this week. And, you know, there was warnings about perhaps other airlines. We've had a few drop
Primera.
Off. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the things that you may not think to include, you might just, especially if it's an expensive holiday, you might just want to put through as well, particularly if you're going skiing or snowboarding in Europe soon. You know, all the advice at the moment, because of what's been going on in resorts in Australia, Switzerland, Germany, even in France as well, we've had heavy snowfall and avalanches. They've been shutting peace, blocking off resorts. So you need to make sure that your travel insurance covers you for injuries, cancellations, all that sort of thing.
I actually think that travel insurance for skiers and snowboarders and people who are going away to do those sort of sports, it is definitely the one instance. It should be your default position anyway, but you definitely should get insurance when you book the trip, and you need to make sure it covers everything you're going to be doing. A lot of the policies don't cover certain things, and winter sports, so skiing and snowboarding, are usually in the highest level of sports cover, so you need to make sure that you've got that ticked, because let's face it, it's dangerous, and you know, a lot of injuries do occur when people go skiing, and you want to make sure that you've got the right protection. It's a little bit pricey, But it's worth it for peace of mind, isn't it, Georgie? If you're going away and you want to make sure that you're completely covered for all of these things. And at the end of the day, this week there's been really, really heavy snowfall. People's holidays have been ruined. I saw a hotel that had been sort of, you know, in an avalanche and people had to be rescued. You know, that's, you're alive, great, but your holiday is also ruined at the same time. And if you haven't got great cover, you might not be able to get any kind of conversation from that. And it's kind of... it sounds like common sense, but you'll be surprised the amount of people that may not, you know, get the right cover. And, you know, this has been a good warning this week with all that that's been going on in across Europe.
I'm forever astonished when I hear the stats about travel insurance and how many people don't bother booking it at all. Yeah. And if you do, you book the wrong sort and all sorts of things. All right, well, if you are going on holiday, though, once you've got that out the way, enjoy yourself. Have fun. But I mentioned their dry January a little bit earlier, but it seems our taste for zero or low alcohol beer has been increasing for some time. And as always, it's millennials, young people driving the change. Actually, a bit younger than millennials, isn't it? But anyway, now I'm not doing dry January this year. I tried it for the first time last year. Uh-huh. And I, not to be modest on this one, I became something of an expert, I think, in zero alcohol beer. I would not recommend a trip to Amsterdam in the middle of dry January, especially if you're going around the Heineken. But I have to say, well done to Heineken. They had a great zero alcohol beer. Brewdog as well, that's quite a nice... but I won't go down that too far because there are pretty dire ones still out there. But I wonder if the fact that they've upped their game massively... We've got Adnams, there's an article on your website. The Southwold-based brewer and distiller, they're getting on board, as are lots of other brewers. I wonder if that is upping the game and that's why people are saying, oh, actually, I'll give it a go.
I think you're right, Georgie. Actually, Simon and I have had this conversation quite a bit in the last few weeks. It's quite a hot topic for us at the moment, talking about 0% beers, because we're quite fascinated by the number that have now launched in the last sort of 12 to 24 months. It's become a real sort of trend. You go into a supermarket now, usually at the end of the aisle, you know, facing like the tills, there's like a whole stack of different 0% beers. What it is, first of all, actually, it's worth pointing out that it's a hell of a lot cheaper than regular beer, because they don't have to pay the same duties and taxes on it. It's classed as anything that's below 0.5%. Millennials, actually, I would say it's not really millennials. It's more the generation below that that are pushing a little bit of this drive. Yeah, I think they call it Generation Z, isn't it? Is it Generation Z? Or is it Generation Z? I don't know. But basically, 16 to 24-year-olds
now. They should be drinking anyway, 16-year-olds.
Yeah, but come on, Georgie, I mean...
I didn't start until I was 25.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, I was from Essex. I mean, I couldn't even tell you when it started. But 29% of 16 to 24-year-olds actually class themselves as teetotal, which is... up significantly, and that means people at university and all that sort of thing, you know, which typically you think of like boozed up students. I think there's been a real turn in people doing that. And I think
cost has got a lot to do with that.
Cost has got a lot to do with it. I think the other thing is we're quite... quite vain people now, you know, with social media and all that sort of stuff. People like to be fit, like to keep fit. Alcohol, let's face it, it's probably the biggest obstacle for fitness, because you have a few drinks the night before, your next day you're sluggish, you don't fancy exercise, and it's quite hard to motivate yourself. It's got far less calories in it. So I've got a friend that trains a lot. You know, he does a lot in the gym. He likes to sort of goes on these sort of big health kicks and things. And he's been telling me he's been drinking loads of 0% beer because, you know, he likes the taste of beer. He doesn't like fizzy drinks. He doesn't like sugary orange juices and apple juices and that sort of stuff. So you've basically got a choice of water.
Yeah.
And they've upped their games with these 0% beers, and he's like, you know, quite a few of these now taste really good. My other half was pregnant last year, now had baby in November. She's drunk so much 0% beer in the last 12 months, because we'd be at a barbecue, you know, over the summer, and it's like, oh, is that pregnant lady again? You know, you feel like you're a little bit you know, and what do you drink? You know, it's only so much water you can drink, and, you know, fizzy drinks and all that's not good for your health. Actually, 0% beer's pretty good. It's pretty good for you. It's got, you know, some things in it that are actually pretty decent for you. So she was having one or two, you know, at barbecues and things. We've gone through probably about 12 to 15 different brands. I've tried some are bad, some are good.
Got any favorites?
Yeah, I do like the Ghost Ship, actually. The 0% Ghost Ship, I bought that in the Adnam shop, actually, somewhere in Suffolk, because that's where it's based. I can't remember where we were. But we bought some in there. The guy was really friendly, actually. He said, oh, would you be interested to try the 0% Ghost Ship? And hadn't even seen it, and I was like, yeah, tried it. Bottle's good. I had it on draft when I went to Cambridge recently. Wasn't as good.
Now that's not, I've seen, never seen zero
it was,
on draft.
It was on draft. It wasn't good, no. The ghost ship. Daniel likes Heineken, 0% Heineken, which is the story we had this week in which
the Heineken
boss is basically saying that it's taken on Coca-Cola with alcohol-free booze on tap. Because it is true, if you're out and you're a designated driver, it is quite hard because you want to feel like you've got a drink, I think. A lot of people want to feel like they've got a drink, and there's something horrible about just having a Coke. Do you know what I mean?
I don't want to be having all that caffeine.
You know, and other options aren't great. And actually, it's quite nice to, if you had a pint of 0% beer and you kind of make it last a bit, it just kind of, do you know what I mean?
It's also quite nice to alternate. You know,
it's quite nice to alternate.
I'll have a normal pint and then I can have a...
Exactly. And, like, you know, at the end of the day, it makes you feel like you're still involved without being, like, you know, that sober guy in the corner that, you know, you feel like you're missing out a bit, I guess. So I think this is a trend that's going to continue. As I say, the Heineken boss is very vocal about how this has become, like, the new thing. They sold 15 million bottles of the 0% beer last year. I mean, that's pretty sizable. He reckons it's going to double this year. He reckons they're going to sell...
It wouldn't surprise me. They're going to sell 30 million. So not a flash in the pan, then.
Yeah, exactly. So they're going to sell 30 million. The one loser in all this, though, is a pub, I would say. Pubs are already sort of struggling. They've got high rates on alcohol. You know, price of a pint is getting expensive. It's getting to a point where I'm going...
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of money. You know, this is money based in Kensington. Go and get an... Like, you know, you're... bog standard pint of lager, yeah, you're looking £5.50, £6. You know, it's a lot of money, and it's kind of like,
and not just in the poshy areas,
it's mad. It's just absolutely mad. And then, you know, if it starts selling 0%, I don't know how much pubs would be keen to push it, because they can't charge what they charge for a normal beer. Well, they shouldn't, because there's nowhere near the same duty and stuff charged on it. So,
but I have the converse view to that. I actually think that if they have more offerings of 0%, you're going to get a different clientele in, and you're going to get them ordering more. I don't know. I'm
it's an argument there to be had. But I think there's a big. We've got some data actually on the website today about how many coffee shops are opening and how many people are turning to coffee. We spent £10 billion
That's
in cafes last year.
That has
got to stop. People seem to be substituting alcohol with coffee, or now 0% beers, which, look, it's not necessarily a terrible thing. You know, that we're cutting down on alcohol intake. You know, it is responsible for a lot of strain on the NHS, especially at the weekends. Look, the trend's going to continue. I think the beer's going to continue to get nicer as they invest more money in it, where they realise that actually people want this product and want it to be of good quality. There's nothing worse than alcohol that doesn't taste like alcohol. We've tried a couple of wines and...
cider is...
That's apple juice. I think that's called apple cider,
apple
Georgie.
Apple cider, but sweeter and horrible.
We've tried... The M&S have launched... I don't know if it's meant to be champagne or Prosecco, but it's called Fizzero. They've got a rosé version and a white version, and it's all fancy packaged and, you know, corked, and, you know, I think it costs about £4 a bottle, so it's not expensive. It was pleasant, but it's all it is to me. Georgie, is Schlur. Do you remember Schlur?
Yes, I do.
So Schlur is the original one of it, but this is just Schlur in a bit more fancy packaging. That's all I could say, really. So, whereas beer's a little bit different, I feel like beer, it actually still tastes like beer, but some of them don't. But I think it will continue to improve.
We'll see what happens in the year coming up. We should do a taste test on this as
well. We'll do a taste test, actually. There's one that they sell in Whole Foods next door to this money, which is a very expensive shop, but they sell it for 69 pence a bottle. It's Danielle's favourite one. Okay. I think it's Estrella version. It's really good. It's
right.
Really good. 69 pence a bottle.
If anyone has any recommendations, do let us know. You can tweet us or you can email us, and we'll do a bit of a taste test and see which are our favourite. Oh, I do have a story, though, about when I went into a pub, and I think perhaps the attitudes of pubs might need to change on this one. And I did ask if I could have a zero alcohol beer, and I was there with a mate of mine who was a bloke, and he was sat down and he said, "Are you all right, love?"
Yeah, see, that's the thing. That's
assuming that I was on a date and it was going wrong, and that's why I wanted to order zero alcohol.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's just strange, isn't it? People are odd about things like that, and it's kind of like that narrative needs to change, doesn't it, Georgie? It's kind of like you want a 0% beer because you want a 0% beer, not because of anything else. You that's what you want. Yeah. And I hate that kind of judgment of people, like, oh, get yourself a real pint. You know, at the end of the day, I'll get myself a real pint if I want a real pint, but there might be a reason behind the fact that I'm getting a 0% beer, so just live with it.
There you go. Yeah. There you go, Lee. All right, you wait ages for one, and then three coin stories come along at once, and who better to talk through them than Lee, the coin man, Boyce, the man who put coins back on the news agenda. I don't think that's saying too much, Lee. If I'm honest.
Well, I did win coin story of the year last year, Georgie. So, yeah, I mean, the trophy's on my desk. So, I mean, what can I say?
Award-winning Lee the Coin Man, boys. Okay, so the three stories we've got coming up. So one, with all things, exactly, all things Europe on the agenda at the moment, this is money, have been taking a look at some of the rarest, most valuable coins from the continent that you could have picked up on your travels. Also, we have a special set of five coins from the Royal Mint celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 50 pence piece. That sold out in just over an hour. But if you miss that boat for the third story for a short period of time, visitors to the Royal Mint Experience in Wales can strike their own 50 pence new pence coin in honour of that anniversary. So, Lee, let's just go through the first one with the rare coins from the continent.
Oh, Georgie, you know where to come for all of your solid, exciting coin news, don't you? I mean, wow, we've had some big hitters.
You've got a bit ruddy of your face. Oh, you're a bit excited,
look, you know,
Lee.
I'm passionate about this. I think it's a really sort of fun, you know, topic of discussion. So anyway, I had this thought a few months ago, thinking, how many of us have foreign coins just rattling around at home that we've brought back where you haven't been able to quite spend it in the duty free? You know, when you kind of go around and you buy kind of like an oversized Toblerone with those coins, because when you've been away, you just keep spending notes and you never get rid of your coins, and you end up with like 24 euros worth of coins rattling around. Now, everyone's probably got some floating around at home. I remember we had some in a piggy bank. We took it to Metro Bank, this big piggy bank with English coins and European coins, just bunged it all into its magic machine and it just spat out all of these like euros.
I was going to say, did it convert all of them? That's amazing.
We're just too lazy to take them out. Now, there are some coins though. This is where my thought process was, that there must be, like Britain, some that are, you know, hardly go for a mint run at all. You know, not many are struck at all. So there are examples. So if you've got an Italian 2002 1 cent coin, 7,000 were struck on 2 cent blanks, right? So it's actually, it looks like a 2 cent coin, but they've minted the 1 euro on it, right?
Okay.
So there's only 7,000 of those. They're blank errors, they call them out there, and it features the Castro del Monte in Perugia, if you're interested. That's what's on the coin. One of them sold for 6,600 euros at auction. And it started at 2,500 euros. So only a dozen or so of these coins have actually been found, which suggests there's quite a lot of them out there to be found. Because Europe's obviously a big place, they can end up all over the shop. They're not necessarily just going to turn up in Italy. So the advice is from experts, if you've travelled in northern Italy in the last two decades, in the last 17 years, have a look.
Oh, I have.
Have a look, Georgie. Have a look. Look at those foreign coins. If you've got a 2 cent coin with a 1 cent stamp on it, you could be in the money. Some other examples, there's a 2002 Greek 2 euro coin. It had a mintage of 75 million, so not rare at all. But there are some examples that have got an error. It's got an S in the star at the bottom. We've got pictures of these on the website, by the way. These ones were minted in Finland rather than Greece, and they're very rare. We don't know how many there are, but they sell for about 500 quid. There's a Finnish 2 euro worth £70. It tends to sell on about £70. Quite a low mintage of these. So have a look, see what you've got. And there's other examples on the website. So have a look on there. If you Google euro mintage figures, you'll find a whole list of how many of each coin were minted. If you've got any that are quite rare, check the price on eBay. Don't forget that you can list on eBay for any price. But see if any of these coins are selling, and if they're selling for quite tidy sums, why not make some money out of it? So it's a fun little exercise. It's good to get the kids involved as well. You know what those euros got? Look, have a see if you can have a look around and list some of them on eBay and
get
make some cash.
Work.
Look, if you've got a 2 euro coin that's worth 50 quid, it's worth a bit of effort to dig it out. So check out the story on the website. It's got all the pictures on there. Worth a look.
All the pictures.
Yeah, well, you need the pictures. You need the visuals, Georgie. It's hard on radio, isn't it, for me to describe what certain euro coins look like.
No, I'm just laughing at you there, just scrolling through the pictures. So the other two stories we've got all relate to the 50th anniversary of the 50 pence piece. But what's this about a set of coins selling out in an hour?
Yeah, an
hour. Like rock star tickets here or something.
An hour?
An hour?
Yeah, so basically, they went on sale at 9 o'clock. one morning this week, and there was a queue to get on the website, which does happen from time to time, to get on the Royal Mint website. They were selling 5 coins in a set, right? That's £2.50 worth of coins. Limited edition, though, yeah. Right? So they had 3,500 of the basic proof coins available for £90. £2.50 worth of coin. Again, I'll just reiterate. They had 1,969 silver sets, so silver proof, £225. And there were 75 sets created in gold, £3,825.
How much are they going on eBay
for at the moment? I haven't actually checked that, Georgie. No, we were looking at the basic proof ones. Of course, what happens is people have bought them and they've been listing them for inflated prices on eBay. The 5 set of basic proof coins, you know, £500, people just bought them and listed them for £500. Quick flip. If anyone pays £500, I'll be surprised. But people will pay a little premium for that sort of thing. So the Royal Mint's very clever at this sort of stuff now. They've cottoned on to how popular it is and the market on places like eBay, secondary market.
Have they sent you a thank you letter for increasing popularity of coins?
I think that they did take me on a tour around the Royal Mint. Right, that's okay. After there was quite a lot of criticism that I gave them over commemorative coins, which aren't actually legal tender because you can't take them into the bank anymore and cash them over. Do you remember that whole scandal, Georgie?
I
sometimes reread that story, just think that was a great story. You know, really, really sort of like, just I see people tweet it occasionally. I think, yeah, it was a great story.
Even if I did say so myself.
So, yeah, so there's this special set. I think one of the set is actually they've reissued the Kew Gardens 50p, which of course is the holy grail of 50p coin collecting, because there was only 210,000 minted, which is a very low run for a coin that actually circulates. That rarity factor means that people want them for their collections and they're willing to pay a premium for them, and they're now sort of frequently going for £75 to £100 on eBay.
Goodness.
For a 50p coin, it is worth checking if you've got one of those, because that is worth some good money.
Bad.
And then lastly, Georgie, the last coin story. God, it's been, as I say, an
exciting
week for coins. I've done this. So when I went to the Royal Mint Experience, which is in Wales, it's about an hour outside of Cardiff, which is actually really good. I know I've
My
got
granddad
a passion.
Used to work at the Royal Mint.
Really?
Yeah.
I know I've got a passion for coins, but it is actually quite a good attraction. They've got quite a lot of like history and, you know, it's a good day out. When you're there, you can strike your own coin, which, as Grace, our reporter, said, she thought it meant you kind of sort of chisel it yourself, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. Like, yeah, actually, it does conjure images of that, doesn't it? Strike your own coin. You're kind of like...
Might as well, you know, you put a penny in a machine
and it can squish
it. And then
it's not even that. No? So they put the coin in for you in this machine, you press a button and then it stamps it on.
It.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I did it for...
Got your name on it or anything?
No, it's just a regular coin. But here's the crux and exciting part of the matter, Georgie. I actually went and did the 12-sided £1 coin before it launched. So I did it in January... I think December or January, and it launched into March. So I had a 12-sided £1 coin before anyone else. I should have put it on eBay for
£1,000.
But it's a nice little keepsake. I've got it at home. Lovely. They've done other versions of it since. So, for example, you could have gone there last year and struck your own Isaac Newton 50p. Now, that was a circulating coin. There was 1.8 million of them made. They were dated 2017, those Isaac Newton coins. If you went last year to the Mint and stamped your own Isaac Newton coin, it had 2018 on it, which sounds like a small difference, but it means there are far, far fewer of them than the 2017 Isaac Newton coins, because there wasn't any circulating 2018 coins. For that reason, they actually do sell on eBay for about £50. So you could have coined it in if you went there and struck 5 of those, because there's a limit of 5 per person. If you've got 5 of those and you put them on eBay, you could be sitting on a tidy little profit there, because they're collectible for the simple fact there's not many of them. Now, you could do the same again. They're letting people do 50p new pence. So new pence used to feature on coins. It used to be the wording on the coin. It hasn't been on a coin since 1982 because they're not new anymore. Aww. You know. So you can go there now and stamp your own 50 pence new pence coin. You can get 5, as I say, maximum. It comes at a cost, though. So it costs £13 to get into the experience, which is not a bad price, to be fair. You have to get there. You have to pay £13 to get in. You have to pay £6.90 to strike the coin. Bearing in mind, again, this is a 50 pence coin. And then after that, if you want to strike any more, it's £8.90 per coin. So you could come out with a £55.50 bill, which is the 5 coins and the ticket to get in. But they are starting to be listed on eBay for around about £20, and it might go up depending on how many people do it. So it could be a sort of future collector's item worth keeping an eye on. And if you're there, it's worth to strike a one. If you can sell it for a profit, great. If you don't, it's a nice little keepsake.
Yeah, and if you're born in 1982, an added bonus.
No, it doesn't say 1982 on the coin.
Oh, didn't you say that was the last time that it was?
That was the last time that Lee Pence was on the coin.
Yeah.
Yeah. You still get them in your
I'm
change.
Only mentioning it because that might be my birth year.
Oh, I got you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's 1982. Yeah.
Never mind. Lee.
Are you that old, Georgie?
Damn you. Right. All right, Lee. All right. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you would like to get in contact with us, give us some tips on your zero alcohol beer or any coin stories for Lee, or just to talk about coins and show Lee some pictures. Lee, how can people get in contact?
You can tweet us at This Is Money. You can go on our Facebook page, which is again This Is Money, or you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us and also gives me some good financial tips as well. So everyone's a winner.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.